you have to keep in mind that what the book is. And the book is about the groom and the bride. It's about the bride coming to know the groom, coming to know Jesus from our perspective, and then maturing spiritually. Remember, at first she's all like giddy and living in a nice house, and she says, "Oh, this is really nice, and I'm just sitting here hanging out." And he says, "Come on, let's go out in the thing." And she goes, "Oh, no, no, you go out in the thing. I'm just going to hang out over here. I'm just going to relax in the house." And then he tests her by disappearing for a while. Then he comes back. Then he realizes she realizes he doesn't want him to disappear anymore because she needs him. And it's a matter of he's always calling her beautiful and fair and without spot or blemish. And she's a mess. And then it gets to, she sees this, it talks about this procession of King Solomon with the carriage coming to pick up the bride, going to the marriage supper of the Lamb, which we're all going to, because heaven's called the marriage supper of the Lamb. And then he talks about how he's got to go to the mountain of myrrh, which is going to be the suffering. And she says, "I'm going to go with you." So then after that, the whole book changes where she, instead of talking about herself in the first person, saying, "I do this, my garden, my house," but then she starts talking about your garden, your house, her emphasis changes from herself to him. And because she's accepted the idea that she's going to go to this mountain of myrrh, he then says, "Okay, now you're the beautiful, mature bride." And of course, she hasn't done anything yet, but he's given her all these beautiful compliments about what she is and what she's doing, and she hasn't actually done anything yet. So now she's mature to the point where she realizes that this relationship is a serious, deep thing that isn't just going to be fun and games. It isn't going to be Jesus loves me, I love him, everything's great. It isn't going to be, let's go to church, let's have fun, let's go out to brunch. It's going to be a matter of commitment, and there's going to be suffering involved. And it's like, it always reminds me of in John 21 where Jesus takes Peter aside. This is after the resurrection, it's just before the ascension. And Jesus had cooked them breakfast on the shore. And they eat fish and bread, and then he says to Peter, "Come over here a minute." And Peter's probably thinking, "Oh boy, here we go. Denied him three times. Now I'm going to get it." But, you know, he asked him, "Do you love me? Do you love me? Do you love me?" And, you know, he's using the word for supernatural love, and Peter's answering with, "You know, you're really fun to hang out with, and I really like you a lot. You know, you're like my brother." And he says, "But do you love me?" He goes, "Yeah, you know, you're like my brother. I really like hanging out with you." And finally Jesus says, "Okay, I have to take that." He says, "Now that you make that commitment, you're going to get bound. You're going to be taken places you don't want to go by people you don't want to be with. In other words, now that you're following me, you're going to suffer." You know, he says, "When you were young, you went where you put on whatever clothes you wanted. You went where you wanted to go. Now, no. Now they're going to take you places you don't want to go." And there's a commitment thing there which involves the mountain of myrrh. So he talks to her through the end of chapter 4 about how beautiful she is and how they have this garden together. And then along with calling her his bride, he also starts to refer to her as his sister. "My sister, my spouse. My sister, my spouse." Now, I think that's important. How is she his sister? How is any human being Jesus' brother or sister? Because he's human, right? He's 100% human. So he has 100% humanity from Adam and Eve, right? As do all of us. So in his humanity, he's our brother in the sense that we share humanity together. Remember in Hebrews it said he's not ashamed to call us brethren. So in his human nature, he's related to us through Adam. Now, he's related to the Jews through Abraham. We don't have that connection, but it's okay. Humanity still is what's important. So when he calls her my sister, he's looking at the physical human relationship, and the bride, of course, is the spiritual fundamental relationship, because the church is always called the bride of Christ. Heaven's always called the marriage supper of the Lamb. All through Revelation, you have the Lamb waiting for the bride. And the whole concept toward the end of Revelation is the bride comes to the groom and is presented to the father. So the father gets the family because it's the bride of his son. And so the whole message of salvation is, you know, consummated, so to speak. So he says, my sister, my bride. So we're humanly related to him, and we're also his bride. Just like he's 100% man and 100% God, not a mixture, not some fraction of both natures. He's 100% of both. Right? So in that sense, he's our human brother. We went through some of that when we did Hebrews. So then they got these they got this garden where there's spices and there's fruits, and because now that she's committed to him in a way that's much more fundamental, now she's going to bear fruit, and now things are going to go forward, which they weren't going to do before. And we get to part of it is we get to be in the garden with him. If you see in, we're going to start in 5 verse 2, but you see in verse 1, it says, come to my garden, my sister, my bride. I gather my myrrh with my spice. In other words, there's going to be suffering and there's going to be good things. I eat my honeycomb with my honey. I drink my wine with my milk. Eat, O friends, and drink. Drink deeply, O lovers. So we're going to get all these rewards because we're the bride, but we have to go through suffering too. So the myrrh's gathered up with all the other good stuff. This next little passage here, you're going to start to see some amazing thing happen. Somebody read verse 2.
But my heart kept vigil. I heard my lover knocking. Open to me, my sister, my beloved, my doubt, my perfect one. For my head is wet with dew, my locks with moisture of the night.
So now, she's asleep. See, that says, I slept. She's asleep. But now Jesus reveals himself to her as the one who suffers in Gethsemane. Now he's going to talk about the fellowship of suffering. And you see, he calls her my dove, my perfect one. So he's still telling her how beautiful she is. She's sleeping. She hasn't done anything yet. She hasn't picked any fruit. She hasn't evangelized anybody. She hasn't moved a muscle doing anything. All she's done so far is say, I'll go with you to the mountain of myrrh. So then he goes, you know, 13 times he calls her beautiful in the whole song. So calls her my dove, my perfect one. Now, is she perfect? No, before he wanted her to come and she said, oh, no, no. You go leap through the woods and stuff. I'm going to stay here. You know, he calls us and says, come and do this. We say, oh, no, you know, have somebody else go do that. You know, have the priest go do that. Have the ministers go do that. I'm staying home and watching the football game today. And I'm going to relax. So, but he still says, he still calls her my perfect one. So now look how he presents himself. My head is wet with dew. My locks with the drops of the night. Okay. Now he's going to present himself as the one who's suffering. She's sleeping. But she's sleeping in faith. Paul talks about this in Philippians 3. She's resting. a lot differently than she was at the beginning of the book. Because now she's totally committed, so she's resting in faith. So now, remember, she prayed for the north wind and the south wind, and the north wind was the cold wind of suffering. So now it's coming. So she hears his voice again. So even though she's physically sleeping, she's spiritually awake because she hears it. You know, we can hear him when we're sleeping. We can hear him when we're, you know, kind of drowsy and not really doing anything. We can hear him when we're going about our normal life, but it's harder to hear him then. We can hear him when we're watching TV and not really thinking about him, but once in a while the voice breaks through, right? You probably experience that. And so now she hears his voice again because she's mature now, so she's spiritually listening for him. You know, as you get to be a more mature Christian, a more mature believer, you're more tuned in to his voice. You've kind of learned the pattern of it. You probably all know that it's like, you don't hear some booming voice through a megaphone. It's usually a little thing. Then after a while you say, oh, that's him telling me. Because it's different than the other voices. It's different pitch, it's different volume, it's different type of words. Because the world and the demons have all kind of voices too that you hear. But when you're tuned in, when you're more mature, like he said, you know, my sheep hear my voice. Right? But he goes into the sheepfold in John chapter 10. You know, he says, I go into the sheepfold and the sheep know who I am. Because my sheep hear my voice. And I call them by name and they hear my voice. And then it says, I lead them out of the sheepfold. He doesn't herd them. He doesn't hit them with this thing and go, come on, come on, we're going out. He walks out and says, come on. And he says, I lead them out of the sheepfold. And they're not going to follow a stranger. Right? So in other words, you're tuned into his voice. So he's your shepherd. So when he says something, you're going to say, here I come. He's not always going to say, here I come, but oh yeah, you're going to know that he's calling you for something. Just like the sheep. I lead them out. And then, you know, he takes them to green pastures and by still waters. Sheep will never drink water out of water that's moving. They always have to have still water because they can't swim. They can't run. They can't do anything. And the sheep will never lie down unless it's totally satisfied food-wise. They're always eating. They're always moving. So he says you're going to lie down by still waters. So it means you're going to be in a perfect situation where you're going to be satisfied and everything's going to be the way you want it to be. But the sheep are going to hear his voice. You see there he calls her by four names. My sister. That's his humanity. We talked about that. Talks about love. He's going to suffer. Everything he suffers because of love. Gethsemane, which this is actually about, is all because of love. The cross is all because of love. It's the ultimate love. Remember when he says, let this cup pass from me, he's not talking about, you know, some little cup of water or cup of wine. He's talking about the cup of God's wrath. He says, no, but I know I have to drink it. So the cup of wrath poured out on him. So that's the ultimate love. He's going to suffer all this because of love. And then he calls her the dove. Remember, doves don't have peripheral vision. They only look forward. So it's a singleness of mind and her vision's fixed on him. So as you become a more and more mature believer, your vision's fixed on him. So when somebody says, oh, what about this over here? You say, oh, I'm going this way. Or somebody says, well, what about this over here? You say, no, I'm going that way. Because it's single purpose, single mind. And he calls her the perfect one. Because now she's mature enough that she understands what he's going to do and she's going to follow. Even if it means suffering. So, see, you see there it says that, His head's wet with the dew and his locks with the drops of the night. So his hair's like all wet from sweat, from dew. And this is the long night of agony in the garden. It's the embracing suffering. See, we don't understand that because we hear that story so many times. The agony in the garden is not just the agony of, oh, they're going to kill me in the morning. It's a much deeper agony than that. He not only knows what he's going to go through physically, but what he's going to go through spiritually, so to speak. He's going to become sin. 2 Corinthians 5:21. He who did not know sin became sin. Galatians 3:13. He becomes the curse so that we can get the promises. So that's the real agony that he has. Not so much the execution. Like if one of us was going to be executed in the morning, it would be a pretty agonizing night. Don't you think? You're not going to say, well, I better get a good night's sleep because in the morning, you know, I want to be rested when they kill me. But we would be thinking about what's his physical death going to be like. He's thinking about what is this whole experience of every sin being put on him is going to be like. So one teacher described it as he suffered more than all the suffering of every human being combined by the fact that every sin was put on him. So this is what Gethsemane is really about. You know, to us it's a reading we do, you know, Good Friday and say, oh yeah, it was terrible. But when you really think about it, it's unbelievable. And you know, he's talking to her. See, it says there, she's asleep. And he's talking to her through the door. See, she says, hark, my beloved is knocking. So he's knocking on the door, telling her this. You know, it's Revelation 3:20, stands at the door and knocks. He wants her to open so she understands his suffering. He wants us to open to that so we understand the suffering. You know, when you hear people say, oh, I had a toothache, but I offered it up. Big deal. That's nothing. He wants you to understand the suffering that he did. Because that's your salvation. Not that you have to suffer like that. No one's ever going to suffer like that. You're going to suffer in some sense, but your suffering is not going to save you. His suffering is going to save you. So he's talking to her basically through the door again. Okay, now somebody read verse 3.
I'm already undressed. Why should I get dressed again? I have washed my feet. Why should I get them dirty again?
That sounds kind of weird. Anyway, see, we're covered with Jesus' robe of righteousness. And that's talked about in Isaiah 61, Zechariah 3, Romans 13. We're covered with righteousness. If you read Romans 3 and 13, actually, I should have put 3 and 2. We're covered by his righteousness because we don't really have a lot of our own. Remember, she thinks she's dirty. Remember, she kept saying, I'm dark. You know, why do you say I'm beautiful when I'm dark? And he says, no, you're white. But see, her robes are filthy. Isaiah 64:6. Our robes are filthy. Our good works are like a pile of filthy rags. And she doesn't want to put those robes on again, the dirty robes. I don't want to put my dirty robes on again. I want to keep his robes on. You know, the prodigal son. You know, Luke 15. It's about three lost things. The sheep, the coin, and the son. So the prodigal son, remember, he's reduced to living with the pigs and taking care of the pigs. Now, when you read that parable, we'll do that some other time, but when you read that parable, it tells you that when he's telling that story, the common people, the people that the Pharisees called the people of the land, the, you know, people that they didn't like, were listening to the story. It says the Pharisees were murmuring. What's he talking about? So, can you now, and Jesus is such a great storyteller, of course, that he always manages to get in the thing about pigs or Samaritans, because he knows that's going to get him. So when he says the guy's living with the pigs, you can imagine him going, oof. I mean, that would be like the depths that somebody could sink to. There couldn't be anything worse if you're a nice Jewish man than having to live with pigs. There wouldn't be anything worse. So, you know, it, and then when he comes back to his father, he's got these smelly, disgusting clothes on. And what does he say the father does? He puts the robe right over his clothes. Right? He doesn't tell him, go take a shower, wash up, shave, clean yourself up, come back, and then I'm going to put the robes on you. He puts the robe on him, the ring on him, the shoes on him, while he's still a smelly mess. Remember in Romans, it says, while we're still sinners, Christ died for us. He didn't say to those, to all those people, you go someplace for 14 years and make yourself pure, and then I'll die for you. He died for us while we were still sinners. So the robes of righteousness, she doesn't want her filthy robes. She doesn't want to go back to what she was before. I don't want those robes back. I want to keep your robes on. And washing feet, you know, has to do with spiritual cleanliness. It comes from the, you know, Last Supper. Jesus washes the feet. You know, when you went to somebody's house, the lowest servant washed your feet because your feet were all disgusting, walking through sand. So that's a spiritual cleaning. You know, it's not quite like the mikvah bath, but it's similar. So she's been clean, and she's got his robes on. So she doesn't want to get dirty anymore. Why should I get my feet dirty again? He's already cleaned them. I took off my old garments. I don't want to put those back on. When you become a mature believer, you don't want to go back to living like you were before. The prodigal son didn't want to put his dirty clothes on and go back to the pigs. Although the older son would have probably liked that if he did. But not to, you know, the older son always gets a bad rap. But remember, the father says, all I have is yours. He doesn't despise the older son. He just wants the older son to understand that the younger son needs grace and mercy. And that's why, like, legalistic people who follow laws and do all the things say, well, that guy doesn't follow any laws. How come the party's for him? The party should be for me. I'm doing all the stuff, not him. But, you know, it's a perfect, the reason Jesus tells that story is it shows you salvation. As long as you're willing to come back, not only is he going to take you back, you're going to get the robe, the rings, and all the stuff. So she doesn't want the old robes. Okay, now somebody read 4. So now he opens the door. See? My beloved put his hand to the latch. My heart was thrilled because grace unlocks her heart. His grace, love, mercy unlocks her heart and affects everything about her because she yearns now to be with him. So when he shows up, she wants to be with him. At the beginning, she said, oh, yeah, he's pretty cool. He's nice. And I got this nice house now because of him and everything smells good. So this is okay. Now she just wants to be with him. She doesn't care what he looks like. And he looks bad now, too. He's all covered with sweat and water. She just wants to be with him. The grace unlocks her heart. And somebody read 5.
I rose to open to my lover with my hands dipping there, with my fingers dripping choice myrrh upon the fittings of the lock.
So she goes to open the door, and what's this thing with liquid myrrh? That sounds kind of weird. So Jesus starts to unlock the door. She opens the door. Myrrh refers to, she's not thinking about herself anymore. She's dead to herself. She wants to open the door and be with him rather than worry about the fact that she was sleeping and why did he have to come here and wake me up? You know, I'm just trying to relax here and he showed up again. You know, she's died to herself, as Paul says. You know, Paul says, it's not me who lives anymore. It's Christ who lives in me. The old me was crucified, was nailed to the cross. Now it's Christ that lives in me. So she's embracing the cross. She's embracing what he's going to do, what he's done, and says, it's not about me anymore. I'm dead to myself. It's not about me. This is part of her commitment to go to the mountain of myrrh. She'll accept the suffering, even though it's very uncomfortable for her. She's not going to necessarily want to go where she has to go, but she's now committed to it because she committed to go up to the mountain of myrrh. So when she unlocks the door, she knows the suffering is coming. It's in her hand already. Now, this is the suffering Messiah that's in front of her. He's not all clean and glorious. He's covered with dew and he's all wet. You know, you gotta embrace the suffering Messiah before you can have the glorious Messiah. Right? You're gonna get the glorious Messiah. Everybody's gonna get the glorious Messiah. He's gonna come with a rod of iron in his hand and fire in his eyes. And he's not gonna be cute little baby Jesus at Christmas. He's not going to be, oh, I love Jesus. Jesus loves me. His robes are going to be all covered with blood, and it isn't his blood. His people are going to be judged and in serious trouble. But for us, it's going to be good. Hope he comes back tonight. For us, it's going to be good. But for a lot of people, most people, a lot of people, we don't know what the percentage is. It's not going to be good. Because he comes back as a warrior. Comes back as a triumphant king. And with the rod of iron, it says he smashes the nations. So. But here, this is the suffering Messiah here. Okay, now somebody read 6.
Gone. I sought him, but I did not find him. I called for him, but he did not answer.
Oh. So now comes another test. There's always tests that are going to go on. Now, why do tests go on? It's a disciplining. Remember in Hebrews 2, it said, you're always going to, you know, every father disciplines his sons. Everybody disciplines. I mean, if a parent never disciplined their children, what would happen? You'd get public schools. you'd get a bunch of wild people that have never been disciplined. But every father and mother, but the point is the father's the spiritual head. Every father disciplines his children because it makes the children go in a way that they should go. Makes them learn how to behave and what not to do. So you try to form them. So we're not supposed to reject the discipline of the Almighty, it says. Because even though it's hard, later in life you'll understand why it happened. Just like even our kids say to us, well, I'm really glad you guys did that because now I understand. Now I'm glad you guys disciplined us. So if some of their friends are having a free-for-all, and they're, you know, disciplined, eventually they understand that that's good. So in Hebrew, it's in the book of Hebrews, it says you look back on it as an adult and you say, oh, I'm glad I was disciplined. So we're going to go through disciplining as believers, but at the end, we're going to say, oh, now I understand why that happened. You know, at the time, it seemed really horrible. But now we get it. So now there's a twofold test that comes. He withdraws his presence before he withdrew his presence when she was just kind of hanging out. Now she's obedient and committed, and he withdraws his presence. Now, you know, he never goes away completely. He's always there. But he withdraws in a way that you don't sense it necessarily. You know the old story about people say, where were you, Lord, when I was? He says, well, I was there. He just didn't know I was there. You know, I was walking right next to you, but, you know, you were being a smart aleck and you were involved with something else. You didn't even realize it. So now that she's obedient, he kind of pulls back, just like when she was disobedient. But now she really gets even more upset because she leaps up. She wants to be back in his presence. You know, this is a test for her. You know, now she's yearning for him. You see there it says, my soul failed me. I sought him, but found him not. I called him, but he gave no answer. Sometimes in one of these dark nights of the soul, you call and you don't get an answer. Or you want the answer in 15 seconds, but maybe it's going to come 15 months later or whatever. It's not about you. It's not about your time schedule. It's not about your situation. I mean, it's about your situation, but it's not the way you want your situation handled. He's going to handle it in a way that's going to help you because it's going to discipline you. You know what I mean? Just like when you tell a kid, you can go, but you can't go right now. First, you got to do this. And the kid says, no, but I want to go now. And you say, well, too bad. You can't go until you do the whatever it is. Then eventually the kid says, okay, now I understand why I had to do that first. And it's the same with us as believers. We'll understand why we couldn't go do that thing because we had to do this first. This had to happen to us first. So now it's a test, and now she's yearning even more for him. And this is not a satanic, demonic thing. This is a disciplining that the scripture says the father disciplines his children. This is not a satanic thing. I mean, it can be, there can be temptation and stuff involved. But when he pulls back from you and you are thinking, where did he go? What am I doing? You know, he's seeing how you're going to react to these things. Are you going to say, well, you know, yesterday he was with me and now he doesn't even like me anymore because he's gone. Then you flunked the test. See, now she's yearning for him. But we know in Hebrews 13:5, he's never going to leave us or forsake us. So he's not going to disappear. So even though she calls out and he doesn't answer, he's there. It's a disciplining for her, even though he seems not to be hearing her. You can cry out. I mean, something can happen to you tonight and you can cry out and you don't hear him answering you. And you say, oh, see, he doesn't even care. Because we see everything from our perspective. I even went to church today. Now he's not even answering me. Because we always think we're getting points doing things, and so he's going to like us better. But he likes you the same, whether you get the points or not. But it's a disciplining. So now another test. So, verse 7.
The watchman came upon me. As they made their rounds of the city, they struck me and wounded me and took my mantle from me, the guardians of the wall.
Now these are the spiritual authorities. They're the keepers of the walls. They're supposed to be keeping the church safe from the outside. They're supposed to protect the people that are inside, but they can also wound you. Yes. Yes. From his point of view, it's like the Pharisees. From our point of view, you can look at it as leaders of the church can wound you. And, you know, you can be wounded by friends. You know, Jesus was wounded by his friends. We're all wounded by our friends. You know, Paul talks about this in 1 Corinthians. So, you know, you go and say, oh, If you go, say, to your church and say to one of the leaders, oh, you know, I'm having this problem. And he goes, well, you know, I don't have time to talk about this now. You know, why don't you call the office and we'll talk next week. And you leave there going, man, that guy didn't even care. And it's not necessarily that he doesn't care. It's just he can't do it right that minute. So you can be wounded by the authorities. So here, the watchmen are the ones, they took away her mantle. Now, her mantle's her spiritual covering. You know, they took it away because they reprimanded her and said, well, don't worry about that now. Just come to church, sit down, and be quiet. Why can't you just be like everybody else? I just have people say to me, why can't you just go to church on Sunday like a normal person? I say, because I don't want to be a normal person. That's boring. It is boring. So we're not going to get into all the times we've been wounded by priests and leaders and stuff, because we could probably all tell stories. Because, you know, after all, they're human beings too. And they're just as flawed as we are. They're just in a different position. So they beat her up pretty good. You know, they made her feel bad, and they took her spiritual covering away, and they were like, no help in this. You know, I can't find my lover anymore. Where did he go? And they go, well, just sit down and be quiet and don't worry about that now. We got a lot of other stuff we got to do first, kind of thing. Why can't we have a Bible study at the church? We don't have time for that. Just sit down and be quiet. You know, why can't we have a prayer meeting on Tuesday? Still, because nobody's here on Tuesdays. I'm too busy. Nobody's going to be here, so sit down and be quiet. You go, oh, okay. Doesn't that happen a lot? Yeah. So that's what she's talking about. You know, the leaders aren't concerned about her problem at that moment. It doesn't mean they should be concerned. It doesn't necessarily mean they're not concerned, but they're not concerned the way she wants them to be concerned. Because now she's totally committed. Okay, verse 8.
Promise me, women of Jerusalem, that if you find my lover, you will tell him I am weak with passion.
Now, she's lovesick because she can't find him. She's worried, did I offend him? Why did he go away? He's there, but he's pulled back. Because he wants a bride that's going to love and follow regardless of what the circumstances are. So the question is she going to obey him even though she doesn't sense that he's there? But she responds with what? With love, which is good. She says, I'm lovesick. She doesn't say, I'm worried that I'm going to go to hell. I'm worried that I did something wrong and everybody's mad. She says, I'm lovesick. I want him because I'm lovesick. So that's the proper response. Right? Love is always the proper response. Remember faith, hope, and love? The greatest is love. Why is love the greatest thing? You know, those are the three theological virtues, right? Faith, hope, and love. Why is love the greatest one? Right. Think about God's nature. Does God have to have faith? No. Does he have to have hope? No. But he's love. So that's why it's the greatest of the virtues. So she even asked, the daughters of Jerusalem are the less mature people. She says, oh, you know, I'm looking for my lover. If you see him, tell him I'm lovesick. I mean, she's so desperate, she's even calling out to the less mature members. Just like if you have a problem and you're praying and you're not getting an answer and you go to somebody who doesn't have a clue what you're talking about and say, oh, I'm having such a hard time and, you know, I'm praying and he's not answering, and they look at you like, okay. So she responds with love. And then the daughters have a question. Verse 9.
Most beautiful of women, is your lover different from everyone else? What is there so wonderful about him? We should give you a promise.
See? Less mature people. So what's so hot about Jesus? He was really nice, and he was a really good philosopher, and he came to teach us how to live. And those things are true. But, okay, there's lots of great philosophers. You know, Buddha was a great philosopher. Confucius was a great philosopher. Voltaire was a great philosopher. You know, they kind of taught us how to live. You know, Jesus didn't just come to teach us how to live. He just didn't come to teach us philosophy. He came to die for us. And they ask this question because they see she's like all about Jesus. You guys ever experienced that in an average place? Say, why are you talking about Jesus all the time? You're going overboard on this. I mean, you don't say that, but that's the kind of look you get. Like, yeah, okay. So if you start saying, oh, you know, Jesus did this and Jesus, okay. I mean, oh man, Jesus was so awesome. Let me tell you. Yeah. You know, when you get that look like, then you realize they don't understand what you're talking about. Right? Like I say, if you don't think about the cross 20 times a day, you don't get what happened there. And most people don't get what happened there. It's like, oh yeah, 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 that's okay. So they see that she's lovesick for him and she's having some kind of problem and all she's talking about is Jesus. So this kind of, you know, provokes them a little bit. They don't really understand what's going on. They don't get that kind of dedication. That's why when your leader, whether it's the priest, the minister, rabbi, or whoever it is, it's like, well, you know, you gotta tone down a little bit and relax. You gotta think, does he even get what I'm talking about? Because how can you think about anything else? If you think about the church picnic, that's great, but who cares? If you have a picnic every day, that's great. If you have a picnic once every 10 years, who cares? But if you're walking around saying, I want to tell you about Jesus, they say, that's weird. You got to calm down a little bit. Like Paul says, I only talk about Christ and Christ crucified. I only preach Christ and Christ crucified. That's all I want to talk about. And the Corinthians said, dude, you need to relax. We don't want to talk about that anymore. He goes, well, tough. That's what I talk about. So when he'd go to Starbucks and see a couple of his friends sitting at the table, he'd go over and say, let me tell you about Christ and Christ crucified. And they'd say, no, we're talking about the football game. He'd say, tough. All I talk about is Christ and Christ crucified. And they'd go, man, you gotta relax. You're too uptight. Right? You're too uptight. And they don't get this kind of dedication. They say they have, there's other beloveds. The fact that they say, why is your beloved so great? The fact that they got other beloveds. Right? So what's so great about your beloved? We all got beloveds. You know, this goes back to idolatry. This goes back to distractions. This goes back to people that had, you know, at the time the second temple was destroyed, there was idol worship going on in the temple. Oh yeah, you know, we're God, but you know, we better see about this God too, because if he's real, we better make him happy too. You know, we got other beloveds too. So what's so great about yours? You know, there's other things that are just as important or more important. And because of spiritual, you know, the sign of spiritual maturity is what Jesus talks about in Matthew 16, where it's, who do you say that I am? Right? Who do people say that I am? Is basically what he asks. And what do they say? Oh, some say you're the prophet. Some say you're Jeremiah. Some say you're... Because they've got all kind of other beloveds. Anything that distracts you. So when Jesus says, who do they say I am? And they say, oh, you're Moses, you're Jeremiah, you're one of the prophets, you're... He goes, but who do you say that I am? So he can say that to this... He could say that to these people. You talk about other believers, who do you think I am? I am. Who do you think I am? That's the eternal question. So everything rises and falls on what you think he is. Right? If you say, nice guy, good philosopher, good teacher, too bad they killed him, wrong answer. Right? So Peter answers, you know, you're the Messiah, the Son of the living God. Right answer. So, you know, And Jesus points out, Peter, you didn't figure this out on your own. This was revealed to you. Because there's no way you could figure this out on your own. You can't deduce this. There's no equations that tell you that. There's no kind of life experience that tells you that. Because your flesh and blood couldn't have told you this. So that's the right answer. Even Pharaoh asked a similar question back in Exodus, but we don't want to get back to that. But, you know, people say, we all got beloveds. What's so great about your beloved? You know, talk to somebody who's involved. It doesn't even have to be like New Age people. Yeah, yeah. You know, go to Mexico and hear people say, oh, Our Lady of Guadalupe. You know, Jesus is always okay by Our Lady of Guadalupe. Wrong answer. That's idolatry if you put something above him, right? Because he's the one who's going to save you. So it's, you know, Peter gives the right answer. So these less mature believers say, well, why is your beloved more important than, you know, why is he the best of all the beloveds? We all got beloveds. They don't get it. Because what measures up to Gethsemane and the cross? Nothing. I mean, no person, I can't even die for my own sins, let alone anybody else's sins. You know, if you could die for your own sins, well, then you could have somebody murder you and you'd be saved. But you wouldn't be saved. Then 10 through 16, whoa, this is a whole long thing. This is the answer to why is your beloved better than all our beloveds? Because remember now, she's not sure where he is and she's lovesick looking for him to the point where she's telling the people, the leaders, she's telling the less mature people, and they're all, you know, they don't have a grip really of what she's talking about. So then she answers with a pretty cool, actually, why doesn't somebody read 10 through 16?
He stands out among thousands. His head is pure gold. His locks are palm fronds, black as the raven. His eyes are like doves beside running waters. His feet would seem bathed in milk and are set like jewels. His cheeks are like beds of spice with ripening aromatic herbs. His lips are red blossoms. They drip choice myrrh. His arms are rods of gold adorned with chrysolites. His body is a work of ivory covered with sapphires. His legs are columns of marble resting on golden bases. His stature is like the trees of Lebanon, imposing as the cedars. His mouth is sweetness itself. He is all delight, such as my lover, such as my friend. Daughters of Jerusalem.
There's a lot of stuff in here that you hear in songs, you know, and, you know, the Messiah is the fairest of 10,000. That's where this comes from. The ancient Hebrews had 10,000 was like the ultimate number to them. They couldn't imagine numbers above 10,000. So the Messiah is the fairest of 10,000. And 10,000 was also called a myriad. So I said myriads of angels, you know, which means many ten thousands of angels. Yeah. So this is cool. So now the bride answers the question, what's so great about your beloved? Our beloveds are pretty cool. What's so great about your beloved? This is what the Samaritans did. They said, yes, there's God. There's the God of Israel. We keep his Torah, but there's other gods too. The God of Israel's God here, but then there's gods over there, and there's a God over there, and there's a God over there. So they were kind of a mixture of Judaism and paganism, which is why the Jews couldn't stand them, because they were trying to have it both ways, basically. And even though they kept the Torah, they kept the laws of Moses, and that's the only books they kept. They had all these weird ideas about other gods, too. So this is why nobody could stand them. And the Jews would walk around rather than walk through it, because they were sort of the ultimate evil. Even Jesus told his guys, don't minister to Samaritans. The only Samaritan he ministered to was the woman at the well. He never went to Samaria again, even though he cured some Samaritans in, you know, different places. But so now he uses 10 attributes of the human body, each with two descriptions. You know, it's white and he's white and dazzling. He's the fairest of 10,000. See, he's radiant in 10. He's talking about he's radiant and he's the best among 10,000. Now, to us, that doesn't mean anything because we know numbers way higher than 10,000. But to them, it was a big deal. Fairest of 10,000. Just like it says, God owns the cattle on 1,000 hills. Well, 1,000 hills is nothing. But to them, it was a lot. They live in a really little place. So, fairest among 10,000. So, number one is his head. Okay, the head is sovereign leadership over everything. See, his head is the finest gold. Okay, gold is a sign of riches and kingship. It's royalty. That's why the Magi brought gold. He's a king. Right? The gold stands for king. So his head is finest gold. The locks, you know, we already talked about hair. The hair is a sign of dedication. Back in number 6, when you became a Nazirite, you never cut your hair again. You never shaved. A razor never touched you. John the Baptist was a Nazirite. So, razor never touched him, and they never ate anything that came from a grape. But, you know, the hair is a sign of dedication. And in a young man, you know, the hair is like a sign of being vigorous. You know, when you have a young guy who's got, you know, wavy hair, it's a sign of being vigorous. So, you know, wavy hair is a sign of being vigorous. And, you know, he's the eternal high priest. Remember, we did Hebrews in this group, right? Yeah, I think so. So he, as eternal high priest, he's eternally vigorous. You know, he's not going to get tired. He's eternally interceding with the Father. He doesn't do it for a while. Then he says, well, am I going to do this now for the next 5 years? I'm going to take a little break. It's an eternal thing. He's the eternal high priest. Then it goes to his eyes. You know, we're talking about doves again. He's got infinite knowledge, wisdom, discernment, omniscience. It's all characteristics in the eyes. Then his cheeks. Remember, the cheeks are how you tell people's emotions. The cheeks get red, the cheeks get pale. This is a big thing for ancient Jews. They look at people's cheeks. You know, are they blushing? Are they pale? Do they look like they're lying? Whatever. So, you know, his cheeks are a bed of spices. So, you know, it's extravagant. Extravagance of his affection. You can see it in his cheeks. His emotion is one of love and affection. Then it goes down to lips, which, of course, his word comes from his lips. And it's sweet and pure like lilies. Remember, lilies is a sign of purity. They were talking about lilies at the beginning of the book. It's a sign of purity. And the myrrh is, of course, a sign of death. His death, our death, but our death is to ourselves. When we embrace the cross, we die to ourselves. Right? You can't go to the cross arrogantly and say, here I am. And you should be happy I'm here. Because after all, I'm smarter than all those guys you got over there. And I've done more stuff than all those guys over there. And I go to church every single week. So here I am. You haven't died to yourself. You got to go to the cross broken. Hands, of course, are activity. You know, his arms and his hands were gold and jewels. So it's, you know, gold and precious stones. So he does his work with his hands, and it's all good. You know, the ivory has to do with compassion. It's beautiful, carved ivory, or your translation had something else, but some translations have ivory, and I don't remember what yours was, but, you know, when you carve ivory or carve stone, it's a beautiful thing. So, you know, it's rare and it's beautiful. You know, it has to do with beauty and compassion. Then the legs, of course, you walk and you do your purposes. He walks and does his purposes. And your legs walk forward. You don't generally walk backwards. I mean, you can, but isn't, you can't do it for very long. But you walk forward to a purpose. And it's a sign of strength. Your legs are a sign of strength. Now remember, these people are not wusses like we were. You know, like we are. They're walking all the time. Their legs are strong, muscular. You know, we see all these characters as, you know, kind of like we, oh, they're just all so sweet and everything. You know, Jesus was very muscular. Had to be. Because they walked. I mean, oh, we went up to Jerusalem. Well, it's a 100-mile walk. I mean, sure, you know, you can go on a tour bus in a couple hours. You can drive your car in a couple hours. But they walked it. And look at all the work they had to do on the, look at these fishermen, you know, clean the nets, get in the boat, catch the fish, do something with the fish, clean the nets. These guys were muscular. They didn't live very long, but they were muscular. So their legs were very muscular. So the legs are, you know, show that you're walking in a purpose. And the appearance is like Lebanon. Now, why is it always talk about Lebanon? Because Lebanon had these beautiful cedars. You know, Lebanon always is a place of beauty. It's not so much now with Hezbollah and Christians being. Lebanon at one time, you know, Beirut was the Paris of the Middle East, it was called. And even though it was half Muslim, half Christian, it was a beautiful place and everybody lived together and everything was fine. And now it's pretty much of a shambles. But the fact is that Lebanon was beautiful because of the trees and the flowers. We already talked about that in an earlier chapter. So, you know, he blesses people like the Aaronic blessing in number 6. And his speech, of course, is an intimate thing. You know, God talks to you, you talk to him. And this is like, you know, we always say the, here, I mean, you have two amazing things, and one is that God, as creator of the universe and as your creator, wants you to talk to him and wants to talk to you, which is pretty amazing in itself. Remember Psalm 8, who is man that you're mindful of him? Like, real, seems that we're like nothing compared to the rest of the creation. I mean, we're pretty dopey looking compared to like a redwood tree or a galaxy. You know, do you think God would be more impressed with a galaxy than one of us? But no. The galaxies can't talk to him. They do their purpose by, you know, what they do, their purpose in creation, but we're way above that. He wants to have a communication relationship with us. Bride, we're the bride. We're not just friends. He says, I call you friends. We're not just friends. We're the bride. So the creator wants to have a communication with us. And then the whole point of salvation here is the creator becomes the sin bearer. So we can't top that with anything. You know, he's not impressed that we took some food to the hunger center or we went to help decorate the church for Christmas. Those are nice things to do. But the creator became the sin bearer. And that's what it's about. That's why we do the things. So with the mouth, we have intimacy with him because of communication. And then verse 11, The 11th point is at the end. This translation says he's altogether, his speech is most sweet, he's altogether desirable. Most translations say he's altogether lovely, where a song comes from. You know the song, Here I Am to Worship? Altogether lovely, that comes from here. So, you know, it's altogether, you know, altogether lovely, altogether desirable. So all these characteristics say, this is why my beloved is way better than your guys' beloveds. This is a testimony. And then read that last, after that thing about, read the last half of that last verse again.
Such is my lover, and such my friend.
He's my beloved and he's my friend. Okay? The Messiah is your friend. Now, why is he our friend? Because he said he's our friend. He said, I don't call you slaves anymore because a slave doesn't know what their master is about. I call you friends because you know what I'm about. We're friends. He calls us brother and sister, calls us brethren. The book of Hebrews says, not ashamed to call us brethren. Here he says, my sister, my spouse. Human connection. And he says, my beloved is also my friend. You know, and that great song that I really like about the God of Angel Armies is always by my side. The Chris Tomlin song. You know, he says, the one who reigns forever is a friend of mine. So, you know, she summarizes it by saying, all these things I mention, this is my beloved, and he's my friend. Now, you guys got beloveds that are second, third, hundredth rate, and they're not your friends. You guys have no clue what I'm talking about, but this beloved, for these reasons I just mentioned, he's my beloved and he's my friend. So Jesus in his humanity is not only our brother, he's our friend. Relates to us in that way. So even though he's creator, even though he's God, even though he has all this radiance and all these things she mentions, he's also our friend because he's condescended to be our friend. He's not friends with the angels. He's friends with us. Angels aren't his friends. They're his servants. They're his ministering spirits. That's why angels don't like us that much. So how could we be friends? We're so pathetic and rebellious. Well, you know, in 1 Peter it says they struggle to understand these things. And in Hebrews it says they marvel at our redemption. They don't get it. It doesn't make any sense to them because they're there beautiful and intelligent and spirits and they minister to him all the time and look at us compared to them. I mean, there was no, God made no plan of salvation when the angels fell. Right? But Adam and Eve fell, and this whole book came. So they marvel at that. I think it's at the very end of 1 Peter. We'll look it up when we're done. The angels want to look into these things because they don't get it. Like, how does the second person of the Trinity, which the angels have known since they were created, say, well, I'm their, those humans down there, I'm their friend. They go, wait a minute. What do you mean? What do you mean you're their friend? What about us? We're here doing all the stuff. We fly around. We got all this stuff. Yeah, we're singing all the time. How come we're not your friends? But, you know, we just don't get it. So she gives a testimony to these people. And the testimony is not about her. The testimony is about him. She just wants to talk about him. So when Paul says, I only preach Christ and Christ crucified, if somebody says, why? That seems kind of silly. He says, oh, no, because that's how I was saved. That's how you're going to be saved. That's the only thing that matters. All the other stuff doesn't matter. So she focuses, the testimony is about him, and now she forgot about the test that she's under. She forgot about the fact that she's calling to him and he's not answering. Because when she does this testimony, she gets all excited. This is my beloved. This is my friend. You notice that? It's like when you're feeling bad and you start talking about Jesus to somebody, wow, then you feel better. You forgot about your problem. She's not even talking about her test anymore. She sees all these beautiful things about him and explains to these immature people, that's who I'm talking about. That's why I'm like a little crazy about this. Okay, because we're going to go a little bit into 6, even though the thing says it's chapter 5. Okay, 6. See, look, see, you can see it. The book's got 8 chapters, so this is beginning of 6. Okay, somebody read chapter 6, verse 1.
Where has your lover gone, O most beautiful among women? Where has your lover gone that we may seek him?
Okay, so now she's preached to them, basically. And then they remember that she started out by saying, hey, if you see him, tell him I'm lovesick. So she goes, so where did he go? We want to see him too. Now she's awakened in them the idea that they want to see him too. Because of what she said, they see that this bride has intimacy with him, and she knows something they don't know. Haven't you experienced that with people in your church? You got something they don't have. And these aren't like evil people that are out, you know, being card-carrying heathens. These are nice people that go to church. So they see that she has intimacy with them, and they don't have that. So now they ask a question. So where is he? Because we want to find him too. We want to have what you have. We want to know him like you know him. So people say to you, you know, you're doing it, you're talking to people, or you're doing a prayer meeting or a Bible study or something, and people say, hey, I want to know that too. As opposed to the people that say, well, I don't know what you're talking about and I don't really care. So people say, I want to know that too. I want to have what you have. So the question changes from, you know, what is he? What's the big deal about him? To, where can we find him? Because we want to experience this too. So her testimony had a big part in that, right? Because she says, oh, let me tell you about him. Da, 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 da. That's my beloved. That's my friend. And they go, wow, we want to know him too. They don't want to just be, you know, hanging out on the periphery anymore. They want to know him. And they also, they call him your beloved, see? They say, where has your beloved gone? He's not their beloved yet. But we want to know about him. Now, where has your beloved gone? He's not their beloved yet. But they see her as somebody special because she has this relationship. See, they call her fairest among women. They say, wow, you're so awesome that you have this relationship. We want to have that too. Maybe this is better than the other beloveds that we've been doing, whatever they have. So now, because she's been undergoing this test, you know, she made a commitment, she underwent a test, and because now she underwent this test, other people are being changed. So sometimes your trials are also impacting other people, not just impacting you. So now these people are changed because of something that happened to her. And the bride, in parentheses, the church, in parentheses, each individual believer, we're always being tested. And, you know, people are going to watch how you react to things. You know, if you react to a test by saying, oh, God abandoned me, and I don't know. I used to go to church, and now he doesn't like me anymore, and he just let this happen. People who don't believe anything are going to be saying, wow, that doesn't sound like I want to be involved with that. But if you say, well, I'm going through these things, and I know the Lord's going to sustain me through it, and people go, wow. So these other people get impacted, even though she's going through the test. She forgot about the test now because she's impacted these people. So they say, where did he go? Okay, now, verse 2. Actually, 2 and 3.
My lover has gone to his garden where the balsam trees grow. He is feeding his flock in the garden and gathering lilies. My lover is mine, and I am his. He feeds his flock.
So where is he gone? He's gone into his garden, okay? The garden is the church overall. He's gone to the church. The spices are graces that he pours out on the church. Fragrant things. You know, the whole church and local churches and individual people. Remember, the church is not a group of buildings. The church is groups of people. And you have the church, then you have the church, you know, sort of your parish. And then you have individual groups like this. I mean, we're the church, right? Then you have an individual person who's also, he's not the church, but he's the church in terms of he's part of the church. So all these things are poured out on the whole church and local churches and local people, and people get fed. And, you know, he's the fragrance, it says there. He pastures his flocks and gathers the lily. So he takes care of the people. He gives them gifts. He gives them ministries to do. And now she's totally committed to him. She totally belongs to him. You see, verse 3. I am my beloved's, and my beloved is mine. He pastures his flock among the lilies. I'm part of the flock now. I'm his, he's mine. He's in the garden. I'm in the garden too now. You know, before she was talking about, he was talking about gardens and she was talking about gardens. Now she's in the garden. She's part of it. And interestingly too, you know, she gives, back in chapter 1, he talked about feeding his flock among the lilies and, you know, doing these things. If you look back at chapter 1, you'll see that. Now she's the one saying what he said in chapter 1. So she's become the mature bride who says he's got a garden with all kinds of fragrances, all kinds of gifts. He's giving the gifts to everyone, and I'm in the garden too. So now it's a totally different relationship than it was in the beginning.